raised his hands and says, Allahumma inni lam amur bi dhulmi khalqik. O Allah, you be witness. I did not ask my officers to be unjust to the people. If someone from my officer has done this, it's not because I have asked them to do this. And he immediately asked for the paper and pen, and he wrote a letter to this person, instructing him to come back as soon as he gets the letter, so that he can then, you know, present his own side of the story.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Ashura in Britain.
Part 1.
In 680 AD, there was a tragedy that would change the course of history and scar the face of the Muslim community forever. Muslims are ashamed, but also proud.
Actually, what we see is a manifestation of the human spirit, a yearning for justice.
On this day, Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet of Islam, was brutally murdered along with members of his family. This was simply for his objection to the unscrupulous and unethical kingdom of Yazid.
I have a lot of sadness to think that he was the Prophet's grandson and that he was murdered by the caliph of his time, and that it was a senseless death in its way.
And why is the anniversary of his death, Ashura, commemorated throughout the world, even reaching Britain?
Why did Hussein stand and offer his blood? Was it just because he wanted to be killed? Or there was a message?
We go from the Prophet, we go from Ali, who suffered himself a death at the hand of an assassin, and then we move to the next stage, which is the martyrdom of the Prophet's grandson. And so there is a kind of thread, spiritual threads, which connects them all up. And it's a thread which tells us about the fate of a righteous person, a fate of a righteous man.
He knew that he was going to get killed. On the night of Ashura, he told his companions that tomorrow all of us are going to be killed. So anyone who wants to leave, let him leave. He wanted this message to get through to the history that, look, when my grandfather talked about Islam, he did not talk about empire. He did not talk about the Green Palace of Damascus. He did not talk about armies. He did not talk about conquests. What he was concerned about was the spiritual life of Muslims.
It was these principles of Prophet Muhammad that were a source of great inspiration for Hussein. As a child, he looked up to his grandfather as the perfect role model. Prophet loved Hussein dearly.
We know that Hussein as well as his brother Hassan were much loved by the Prophet, and he had them on his knee and played with them. So it's quite a movie. Anybody who's been a father or a grandfather know how lovely that is. Imam Hussein was not just an ordinary man. He was a Prophet's grandson, and he was beloved by the Prophet, and indeed Ali, the Lion of Islam, and the fourth Khalifa.
In fact, Hussein was loved throughout the entire region. During his life, Imam Hussein very quickly became prominent for his drive to help the poor and enrich the lives of orphans, activities for which his father, Imam Ali, had been renowned. For Hussein to have had someone like Imam Ali as a father was a distinct advantage.
He was a strong advocate of human rights. And he had problems with people engaging in high society gatherings where the poor would be ignored.
In fact, this line of the Prophet's family remains to this day a source of spiritual guidance for millions across the world.
They were strong believers in God because they were strong believers in justice. They were strong believers in humanity. They're strong believers against oppression.
Their principles are studied to this day. Being part of this family, Hussein was well known for his exemplary morals. In fact, he is often compared to Jesus Christ, also a key figure in Islam.
What kind of a conversation would take place in between Jesus, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, or Moses if they were in a room together today? All these personalities were the same light. They were the same light giving us the message of humanity. And they cannot be restricted to one faith or one faction, but they belong to the whole world.
Jesus had very great concern for the poor, widows and orphans. Those are all things that I've heard about from the life of Imam Hussein. And he would highlight their experience. So they would have had a lot in common to talk about in how the people at the bottom of society should be raised up to the top so that society was focused on caring for them. And one of the famous sayings of Jesus is, "The first shall be last and the last shall be first." I'm not familiar with all the sayings of Imam Hussein, but I can imagine that he would have said something very similar, and they would have had a lot of similarities talking to each other.
Interestingly, this expression by Jesus reverberates in the Quran. As Hussein would talk amongst his followers, he would have recited this verse about being accountable on the Day of Judgment, that some will be lowered and others will be raised.
That is the last message that Imam Hussein alayhi salam gave to us, to speak against oppression, to speak against tyranny, to speak for the poor, to speak for the oppressed, to raise our voices, to help them.
The role of Imam Hussein mainly, principally, was to observe and enforce the enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil. And he was one man who would not bow down before the despotic and tyrant ruler like Yazid.
But who was Yazid? Quite simply, he was a tyrant, the repressive leader of a brutal regime. He had just been appointed by his father, Muawiyah, to rule over the Muslim world. This appointment would have a devastating effect on the history of Islam.
This was a point of no return. Should Islam the leadership of Islam been kept in the hand of someone like Yazid, we would have now completely a different understanding of Islam. Perhaps we wouldn't have Islam.
He was corrupt in the sense that he would allow mismanagement of the public affairs to be a norm. So it was a total corruption of the right and a total embracing of that which is anti-humanitarian, if you want to put it in those terms.
The Holy Quran considers justice to be the yardstick by which all merits should be measured. Essentially, how can you have peace of mind or peace in society when injustice boasts before your very eyes?
The life that Imam Hussein alayhi salam lives, it actually shouts opposition. He doesn't have to say anything. Just the sheer lifestyle he lives, the sunnah he enacts, is a direct opposition to the lifestyle, to the worldview of the Umayyad dynasty. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam was proactive. He brought the war to Yazid.
Yazid knew that Imam Hussein rejected his leadership. This agitated him. He was also aware of people's hidden love for Hussein.
I think Yazid wanted, by obtaining the legitimacy of Imam Hussein, want to be confirmed in his own authority, and if he did not feel confident that he was, and he must have been aware also of the degree of popular support that the Imam on his side. So it was an attempt to acquire legitimacy, and it was not a legitimacy which was merely, it was not just support of a particular faction, but it was a faction which was a prophet's line. And we know actually even successive caliphs try to get the successors of Imam Hussein on their side.
Yazid knew that he had two choices, either to obtain Imam Hussein's allegiance or to kill him. Either way, Hussein knew that he would not be safe to remain where he was living, just as his grandfather, Prophet Muhammad, all those years ago fled Mecca to Medina. Hussein was now leaving Medina to Mecca. Accompanying him were a small group of close relatives and loyal companions. Whilst Hussein was in Mecca, a movement had begun in a city called Kufa. They had heard of Hussein's refusal to pledge allegiance to Yazid and were gathering support to write letters requesting Hussein to take over leadership in their city.
It is recorded in the history that 18,000 people wrote letters to Hussein, as in some of those letters we read, فَعَجَّلْ ثُمَّ عَجَّلْ, hurry and hurry, we are waiting for you.
The tragedy was that even in the sanctuary of Mecca, Hussein, the beloved grandson of the Prophet, was not safe. He was in danger, a conspiracy to kill him at the hands of the same people who claimed that they were followers of his grandfather.
I think this is one of those most tragic things, that someone like Hussein, peace be on him, had no other choice. He was left in among the Ummah, having no choice, no place to go. And he said, okay, they have told me that they would support me, I'll go to them and talk to them. And he continued moving.
Imam Hussein had actually sent an envoy to Kufa, his trusted cousin, Muslim ibn Aqil. This was to see if the people of Kufa really were committed to the pledge in their letters. On the other hand, Yazid became aware of the atmosphere in Kufa. In response, Yazid sent someone there to repress the uprising. This man was Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad.
In matter of days, he changed the whole atmosphere of Kufa by threatening, by giving promise of wealth, by giving position to people. Suddenly the whole ambience of Kufa was changed, which is very, very shameful, of course. A Muslim doing something like this for the promise of worldly issues.
Yazid's plan to quell the uprising in Kufa was successful. Imam Hussein's cousin was killed. On the way to Kufa, Hussein met a young man named Farazdak, who later became a famous Arab poet. He gave Hussein devastating news about the changes in Kufa and warned him against entering the city.
He said, "Qulubun nas ma'ak wa asyafuhum or suyufuhum alayk." The heart of the people are with you, but their swords are against you because they have sold the swords to Banu Umayyah, to Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. So you are actually entering a city where people like you, but they are going to to meet you with their swords.
Imam Hussein gathered his followers to tell them that the people of Kufa had turned against them.
And our followers, those who sent letters to us, have betrayed us. I just want you to be aware of this, where you are moving to.
In Kufa, Ubaydullah enforced a police state. No one was to enter or exit the city. It was a scary time.
At that time, a man came from Hamdan, a tribe in Yemen, for some business. He came to Kufa for some business and he was caught and he was arrested. And he said, I didn't know, I have come just for business. And Ubaydullah thought that this is the best man to kill because he has no tribe here. We kill him to make an example out of him for others, that anyone capable of taking sword, remaining in Kufa, will be killed. And they killed the poor man, who was quite unaware of what was happening at all.
The army that Ubaydullah had sent was headed by Huor, a military commander. His orders were simple, to capture Hussein and bring him to Kufa. Imam Hussein saw the army from a distance and waited.
Now, the beautiful thing is that Hussein had actually taken lots of water from the previous station. The first thing which appeared to Hussein, peace be on him, was that they were very thirsty. They had rushed. It was middle of the day, they had rushed. Some of them were on foot, some of them were on camels, on horses. And without asking them, why are you here? Are you enemies or are you friends? He told his companions, bring the waters and let them drink. And also let the horses and camels drink.
This is abiding by the rules of war. He was abiding by, you know, the humanitarian values that are meant to be maintained when, you know, a Muslim is in the state of war. So offering water to those who are on the other side, Imam Hussein was always thinking about people as a whole, their destiny. He was always concerned for them.
This was the beautiful thing about it. The sad thing about it was that the first thing Hussein asked her is that, have you come to fight or have you come to support? He said, we have come to fight. And Hussein said, la hawla wa la quwwata illa billah. There's no power but the power of Allah.
Huor wanted to arrest Hussein and take him to the Umayyads. But Hussein resisted. The interesting point was that because Huor respected Hussein and didn't want a confrontation with him, he agreed to let him move in a direction away from Mecca until he received new orders from Ubaydullah. A while later, Huor received this new order, and the order was to force Hussein and his followers to stop and remain where they were. By that time, they had reached one of the most hostile deserts in the region.
When things came to this point, Hussein, peace be on him, asked his companions, what is the name of this place? People, of course, some of his companions were very familiar with the area. And they said, this is Nainawa. And he said, is there any other name? One of them said, this is Ghazariya. And he said, any other name? And one of them said, this special desert is called Karbala. And then Hussein said, Aradu Karban Wabala. This is distress and calamity and agony.
To add to the brutality, the now 30,000 strong army blocked the route to the nearby Euphrates River. This was so that Hussein and his followers would not have access to water.
And that is why the thirst was added to all that agony which was going on. And this actually made the Karbala the whole more tragic incident, that they not only killed the grandson of the Prophet, they killed him while he was thirsty, while his family were thirsty.
A particular detail which lingers in my memory is a terrible thirst, which Imam Hussein suffered during the siege. Karbala was actually quite protracted. You know, many people imagine just one go, but in fact, they're far more drawn out. So in a way, it conveys in a sort of very dramatic way the extent of the suffering.
But the suffering would not end here. Hussein and his followers were cornered. with no routes for escaping. But they would not back down now. Hussein and his followers were ready to stand. With all the respect that Hussein had gathered through his life, why were people ready to kill him?
The Emir of Medina, a commander of the army, everyone, they respected Hussein. They knew that Hussein is not the type of man that they can put up a fight against. However, I don't know, in the heat of that situation, what happened? That people were somehow deceived. اِسْتَحْوَذَ عَلَيْهِمُ الشَّيْطَانِ فَأَنْسَاهُمْ ذِكْرَ اللَّهِ As we have in the Qur'an, Shaitan suddenly overcame them and they forgot dhikrullah and they forgot the people who were the people of Allah.
And in that treacherous heat of deception, the troops who had claimed to be Muslims were about to manifest an ugly face of brutality against the Prophet's grandson.
It was not something that was unexpected. They all knew, even the women and children in that camp knew, that the enemy was not only ready to fight, they were ready to kill.
Whereas Imam Hussein had to do the ultimate sacrifice. And he wasn't a submissive person. He wasn't a lamb going to the slaughter. There was no instance of going there just for the sake of being killed. Imam Hussein, in fact, we know as a fact, he fought. Up to the last drop of his blood.
And Hussein was not only to sacrifice his life, but he was to sacrifice whatever he had and all those who were dearest to him.
There's no way you should compromise with injustice. And that's the example. It's the example with practically all the imams and certainly all the prophets. They displayed this courage. It's the inspiration that he gave everybody, and still does today. It's pretty clear. And so it's a benchmark. It's a... he represents the ultimate sacrifice.
He would provide hope to all the oppressed today. And he would illustrate that numbers mean nothing if you're in the right. He would just mean hope. Numerical majority doesn't count when it comes to right and wrong.
Having the benefit of retrospect, we see how right Hussein was. I mean, he set the example in the history. There is no doubt about it. That is magnificent. The example that Hussein set in the history, I think he did something that his grandfather, the Prophet, peace be on him, expected from him to do, to somehow setting the standard against someone like Yazid.
Over 1,300 years have passed since this event, but Imam Hussein's brutal death is still commemorated. The day is known as Ashura, and remembering its message has spread across the world, including Britain. Why?
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Israeli regime will continue to shed Palestinian blood for fun or for political gain or to consolidate its occupation, says Refaat Al-Arir Ryder in an article published under the heading Without Consequences, Israeli regime will continue to murder Palestinians. Stay tuned for more. Amal is now 2 wars old. No one ever gets used to being bombarded every year or so. The kids in particular live in constant fear, but it does become part of life. As the Israeli missiles rained down on Gaza City recently, Amal, 6, asked her mom, memories of last year's horror still fresh. Will there be another war? During the assault, the children, especially Lina, 9, and Amal, have been mostly quiet. Amal has tried to sleep and Lina lay down in the living room. At night, like most kids in Gaza, they shriek in fear each time they hear an explosion. A report published by Euromed found that about 91% of Palestinian children live in constant trauma and terror due to recurrent Israeli regime attacks. Nothing can prepare you for this. The Zionist regime has been bombarding Gaza ever since the Second Intifada. They never get used to the bombs, and they never know how to deal with the sheer terror and absolute Israeli regime savagery. No lies or hugs or sweets can calm the kids down. When the bombs fall, the kids will always shirk in utter fear. The lies that things will be all right and that these are fireworks no longer work. The Zionist regime had killed at least 30 Palestinians, including 2 Islamic Jihad leaders and a little girl, Ala Qadum, recently. Well over 250 Palestinians have been injured and several homes and buildings have been destroyed or damaged. The Zionist regime's pretext this time is as flimsy as can be. After detaining a senior Islamic Jihad leader in the occupied West Bank, the Zionist regime said it was engaged in a preemptive operation to stop alleged missile attacks before they start. This is like the Zionist regime's war on Gaza in May 2021 and its massive 2014 attack and the many escalations between them. And it brings back memories of the Israeli regime's bombing campaigns in 2012, in 2008 to 2009, 2006, and many others, several of which coincided with Israeli regime elections. Many Palestinians have seen countless of their loved ones murdered in their sleep, or when they were resting and generally minding their own business. If the Zionist regime will kill Palestinians, regardless of who they are or what they are doing, then many Palestinians believe, why not die fighting and defending their country? There is no one more determined or dangerous than a person who has nothing to lose. During the May 2021 aggression, according to Air Wars, in more than 70% of Israeli regime attacks that killed Palestinian civilians, there was no reports of any casualties from the resistance. In other words, civilians were the only victims. According to B'Tselem, an Israeli rights group, nearly two-thirds of more than 2,200 Palestinians the Zionist regime killed in Gaza in 2014 were civilians. Notice that such statistics usually count Palestinian civilian police or resistance fighters killed in their homes as they slept as militants, as they claim. Given these realities, many children, women, and the elderly are not collateral damage, rather they are the Zionist regime's main targets. Indeed, we understand that when the Zionist regime escalates against Palestinians, its political leaders not only receive more votes in elections, they receive more support from Western countries. With the Zionist regime's polls projecting Benjamin Netanyahu to win a majority of more than 60 seats in upcoming elections, the current interim coalition regime, considered to be moderate by many liberals in the West, must have thought a quick war on Gaza might appeal to Israeli regime's electorate. Palestinians have become accustomed to the Zionist regime's carnage when elections approach. Israeli regime leaders know the best way to win votes is to flex their muscles. Their problem, in other words, is not with Netanyahu or the Likud, but with the Israeli regime occupation itself. Yet it is wrong to assume Israeli regime kills Palestinians only when there are elections on the horizon. Israeli and Zionist militias have been massacring Palestinians for approximately 100 years now. The fake regime of Israel is not satisfied with anything but total victory for its colonial rule. Palestinians are not Ukrainians for the role to care about. They are not mostly blonde with blue eyes. They're not Jews. And for being the wrong sort of people, it seems they have to starve, to live in fear and terror, and die without any lifting a finger. The sweets and the kids' favorite pudding remain untouched. Lina and Amal cower against the walls of the living room. They refuse to eat or be entertained. There will be more Israeli regime wars and more Israeli regime massacres. Will the Zionist regime war criminals ever pay for their crimes? Will Arab countries rushing to normalize ties with the fake regime of Israel see it for what it is, an entity built on the violent dispossession and dislocation of Palestinians? Can grassroots organizations and free people, wherever there may be, put more pressure on their governments to boycott and hold the fake regime of Israel accountable? If not, the lies, little and big, will continue. The fake regime of Israel will continue to shed Palestinian blood for fun or for political gain, or to consolidate its occupation, or simply because it can.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. And we would like to actually express our condolences sorrow and sadness for this holy month, the month of Muharram, actually, and the martyrdom of, the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein, alayhi salam, peace be upon him. Well, we're going to talk about some of the laws related to Muharram according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about the Islamic laws about mourning ceremonies during the month of Muharram, according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas, I would like to ask you a question about the Passion Show, or what we call as the, you know, ta'ziyah or reenactment. What's his view on the traditional reenactment of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, you know, which may have some positive effect on the minds of people because they would see the historical accounts, basically, when they see it's like a show to them, you know, and they would, you know, get to know what happened to the, you know, noble families of the infallible, I mean, the Holy Prophet and you know, Imam Hussein and his members of the family.
You're right. It does have a lot of positive effect on the minds of people who go to watch these events and these programs.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people show positive reaction. They have feelings of sadness and grief. They shed tears. I have seen many yes. people from close. And that's why these shows or these, you know, reenactment, traditional reenactment of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his companions are good. Because, as you rightly mentioned, they acquaint people with the history of with what happened on the day of Ashura. His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that there is no objection or harm in such practices, provided that they are not coupled with lies, with falsehood, with exaggeration. Mm-hmm. You know,
mm-hmm.
what actually threatens the religion and the integrity of the religion or the false claims and the exaggerations which are made, and that's not allowed, because when you fabricate stories, then the fabrication will have its negative impact on the audience. So it's very much important to rely on the authentic sources or on the sources or books which have been authored by prominent Shia scholars. There are some very good books written, and these books can be read, can be studied in order to acquaint, especially those who play at the actors, that those who play, that the scenario should be based on the stories mentioned.
On facts,
on
historical
facts.
You're yes.
right. So reenactment programs should not actually undermine the true school of thought, the true school of the Shia, you know, thought, and all concerns must be taken into consideration. And if it is very much likely that those programs might have a negative effect, then of course they should be stopped, and people should not take part in those those gatherings.
I see. Just along with the same line as you just what you said, you know, related to reliable sources, I have a question quite related and pertaining to that, you know.
Sure.
We all know that, you know, lots of or some religious organizations
have their ceremonies, these commemorative gatherings for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, you know. And some of the accounts which are recited in those ceremonies, in those, majalis, in fact, are about how the Imam Hussein, in fact, peace be upon him, was martyred, or his, friends were martyred there in the Battle of Karbala. They are not quoted, we know, some yes. of them, from the reliable sources, you know, and they are heard about, you know, in those majalis, but they said that maybe they heard it from other mujtahids or other scholars, let's say, all right? But when the reciters are asked about the sources of what they say, you know, sometimes they reply that, Ahlul Bayt had taught us this or the same way, and that the account of the Battle of Karbala can be related, can be narrated by way of inspiration as well, and not necessarily through quotation or quoting, right?
Sure.
So the question is, can the historical events be related through inspiration? If it is not the case, what should the position of the listeners of such accounts be?
That's a good question. Recounting the events in such a way without any evidence of an authoritative account or quoting from a reliable hadith has no basis.
Mm-hmm.
It is wrong to say or to use one's imaginative faculty and to say that, okay, I have been inspired or somehow I feel that this could be the true case with the event of Ashura. This is, it has no basis. It's wrong to use one's imaginative faculty
mm-hmm.
to narrate stories which are concocted by the individual himself.
Mm-hmm.
Even we know for sure that the event of Ashura was one of the most, heart-rending events that took place in the human history. But it does not become a license for the individual, for any narrator, for any speaker, for any lecturer to make stories and to narrate to the people what is not found in any books authored by the religious authorities. It has been emphasized by the religious authorities, including His Eminence, that the narrators, the lecturers and speakers and eulogists must quote from the sources, from reliable sources. They should not add anything to the story from themselves. Otherwise, they are, it's the duty of the audience to forbid these people, forbid them, to forbidding evil and enjoining good
mm-hmm.
becomes a duty of the Muslim. Because
right.
if someone is just making right. noise, for mm-hmm. making false claims, then one has to either leave the gathering,
mm-hmm.
or else he should go to the speaker and say, "Where did you say it from? And what are your references?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's important that the speakers should speak based on the references found on reliable references.
I see. Okay, let's take a short break, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
Stars, your eyes pull me to you. Who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces. Who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing. To me, desire, desire.
back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are still talking about the mourning ceremonies and the laws about that, especially during the month of Muharram, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, you know, is it permissible for a woman to be an elegy reciter in such mourning ceremonies or commemorative gatherings, if she knows that men who are non-mahram to her, in fact, would hear her voice?
Well, to be brief, His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, has said that if the fear of vile consequences exists, they should avoid doing so.
Mm.
You know? Because you know, women who act as an elegy reciter or as an eulogist, she might end up, you know, making her voice delicate, attractive, sweet, and she might be heard by men close in the proximity of that building where she is giving an elegy,
mm-hmm.
and so. Instead of doing something good or something which might earn her sawab, she might commit a sin. And if there is such wild consequences, if there is such fear that it may lead to wild consequences, of course, she should avoid doing it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you, my dear audience, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We leave you in Allah's care and please pray for us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it awaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.